Back to your meditation. communication object, which is the felt, physical, tactile sensation of breath as it breathes you. Bring to mind someone who is a spiritual inspiration for you. It could be a historical figure like Mother Mary or Buddha. It could be someone in your life, perhaps a relative like your grandmother. It's someone who really embodies all the highest qualities of a spiritual life for you. As you bring them to mind, begin to really take a moment to admire and enjoy their spiritual goodness, their spiritual qualities, to contemplate those things that inspire, that touch your heart. Feeling how much what it is, appreciating what it is you've received from them. And appreciating naturally turns to gratitude. Our gratitude, we begin to imagine making them offerings. These offerings are just the gift of saying, or a way of saying thank you and please stay in my life. And you can imagine giving them something that we own, or imagine giving them something we don't own, like the most beautiful sunset. And another gift, offering, that teachers, that spiritual guides and mentors truly rejoice in, are those times you've put your inspiration into practice, that you've treated someone kindly, that you acted out of your own spiritual wisdom. I always like to take a moment to see them, to experience them receiving that offering and being so happy that I offered it. if there's anything weighing on your heart. Something that you might want to hide or feel bad about, something you've done. It goes against your own spiritual intuition of how to be in the world. Something you think that they might not approve of, or that you would be of not wanting them to know. And then what we do here is really open our hearts, become transparent in the trust that they will love us and see us and accept us exactly as we are. And so we tell them, I could do this. I did harm someone. I did violence. As we do this, it's not a sense of guilt, and it's a sense of being willing to be transparent and a sense of honest regret that will help us not do this harmful thing again. Time to do the opposite, which is to share something that we're so happy that we did, which could be something positive, like an act of random kindness, or it could be even a moment of refraining from doing something that would have harmed ourselves or someone else. And so we share that with our spiritual mentor. And we rejoice with them in that moment of goodness. And then we stay in our life and ask them to continue to inspire and teach us and guide us in our spiritual path. We see them agreeing. And then, you see them if there's, in our mind's eye, begin to drift up slowly and shrink down till they're just about the size of your thumb and hovering above the crown of your head, just a few inches. And they turn and face the same way you're facing. Like they melt into this warm, loving, liquid nectar light, and they flow down through the crown of your head and right into your heart. And then you feel their presence there. And have the sense that they're always there as a touchstone to help you, teach you, mentor you, guide you, and inspire you. You go through your daily life. You can always call on them. And then we end by dedicating, by giving away the goodness of this, the positive energy of this meditation we've just done, to benefit all living beings and all that they may also quickly end all of the suffering and reach full awakening. And as you're ready, someone nearby you don't know and introduce yourself and say hello.
So tonight we're on the fast train to the end. Okay. I looked at how much I had and I was like, oh my gosh. So it's going to be kind of like a bit of a slideshow presentation. Hopefully not too much information and entertaining enough to keep you going. And then hopefully also have a little bit of time for questions and answers. But if you have a real burning question, feel free to catch our attention. So just a reminder, we're talking about Tibetan Buddhism. And here's Tibet, People's Republic of China, Burma, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. And so you get a sense of where it is and how big it is.
Just so I don't forget, you can answer this. We can talk about it later.
Sure.
I'd be interested in a reference that you think does a good job of describing the differences between the different strains or sects or schools of Tibetan Buddhism.
Yes. Guess what I did? I left the bibliography at home. Mm-hmm. I printed them all out. I got them there.
You have a
printer
again?
Yeah. Okay. We'll see if we can do that. It's on there.
Okay.
The reference is on there. Good question. So the first thing that I just wanted to talk about again is Ryan talked about this last time, that in the Gelugpa tradition, there's this idea of the long rim, the steps on the path. And I was thinking and contemplating about how in all of Buddhism, what's so amazing about what the Buddha taught is he actually said there is this potential and there's a path to realize this potential. And how that path is presented is a little bit different in every tradition. And for us, it's this thing called the long rim, which it was really like a roadmap from A to Z about how to get from being what I like to sometimes think of, or do think of, as a normal schmucky life of being a Buddha, right? And I thought of it analogy-wise as when I became and was training as a nurse midwife, I went into a very intensive program where we got our RN in 1 year, which it's usually done in 2 to 4 years, so it was very super intensive. And I remember walking around the first day in my white coat and thinking, I'm supposed to be a student nurse, you know, like, I'm supposed to have some answers, and someone would ask me, a patient would ask me in the hall something, and my eyes would be this big, like, oh no. But there was something in me, some faith, that if I just kept with the program, that in 3 years down the road, that I would be a nurse and a nurse midwife and have my master's degree. And so it kind of kept me going because I had this idea that that was what was happening. And I realized that's exactly what the Buddha was trying to help us get, was that just the same way that the master's, nurse, midwife, certificate, everything was right there at the end of this path, Buddhahood is right at the end of the path for us. I mean, that really is possible just the same way. And so when it is, sometimes there'd be days as a student I get discouraged, but that image, right, of Buddhahood is something that the Tibetan Buddhists really emphasize. They call it taking the fruition or taking the result as the path. That this idea that when we really get that there is this result, then we will stay on the path and we'll mature and we'll reach our potential. So very, very briefly, it begins that the dark forest, we don't have a spiritual life. We're kind of suffering and have a lot of depression, loss of meaning, just sort of, you know, kind of a normal life where we just feel like something's missing. And then we catch a glimpse, which is like on this distant island, that there's a potential And in Tibetan Buddhism, we catch a glimpse, we often are inspired by, this is actually a teacher here, a spiritual mentor, right? So that's what that meditation we did in part was, you know, who is it that inspires us to get on the path? And so we cross the this river into the great castle, which is our spiritual life. And on the way, it's a little hard to see, but that's a turtle, a big, great big sea turtle, pushing its neck through a golden ring. And it says, having a precious human life, this precious life, with all the opportunities of having a spiritual teachings, is as rare as a turtle, great turtle that surfaces once every 100 to 1,000 years and just happens to put his neck through a golden ring when he surfaces for a breath. I mean, that's how precious our life is. And as we contemplate that, the next contemplation is death is certain, the time of death is unknown, and the only thing we can take with us as we die is our spiritual practice. Okay. And then from there, these are broken teacups, I guess didn't quite show up very well on the big screen, but the idea that not only is death certain, but impermanence of everything is certain. And that causes our suffering, right? We want to hold on to everything as if it's going to last forever. And then we realize that not only am I suffering, but other beings are suffering, which takes us to the six perfections, to this, develop this ability of our heart to really want to get out of the suffering life so that we can help others. That's bodhicitta. That's the Mahayana bodhisattva ideal. And I always think about it as like when I became a lifeguard, right? You have to know how to swim before you jump in and save someone else's who's drowning, or you both go under. And very sadly, I've actually had that happen to a friend who didn't know how to swim, and his son started drowning in a pool, somehow went in too deep, and he jumped in to save them, and they both drowned because he just didn't think about the fact he didn't know how to swim. You know, just in that moment, that parental thing was, I just got to save my child. And so we have to learn how to swim. We have to learn this path so that we can help others, and we have to reach this goal, not just for ourselves, but so that we can be jumping in and as others are drowning. Does that make sense? So that's really understanding that is the underpinning of all of Tibetan Buddhism. That's often broken down in our lineage to the three principal paths of renunciation, which is, renunciation sounds like I have to give up candy or can't ever eat ice cream again. It's not that. It's the idea of renouncing, letting go of a worldview where we expect this world to give us the satisfaction and to, as that very famous Buddha said, I can't get no satisfaction, right? So when we get that out of this life, I can't get no true satisfaction, and recognizing that this life is suffering, and what's going to get me that connection with myself and with others that I long for is a spiritual life, not a life where I get lots of money and kudos and so on. And then the second that comes out of that is bodhicitta, which I just talked about. It's often called the two wings of the bird, right? So that's the ultimate compassion, really being, have this burning desire to reach Buddhahood for the sake of all living beings. And then wisdom, ultimate wisdom, which is shunyata, which is emptiness. So we talked about karma, and when we talk about karma, karma can't exist without emptiness, meaning that emptiness is this idea that if you take, this very quickly, 2 seconds, I'm doing everything like super fast, if you have this object here, and you take our little puppy and comes in and wave it, the puppy's going to start, you know, are they going to write a letter to their little doggy friend? No. So do they see this as a pen?
Yeah.
No, right? If a human comes in, I'll pick it up and start writing someone a note because I see it as a pen. Do I come in and start wagging my tail and think, choo-choo, choo-choo, yay? You know, no, I don't. Because it's available to be either, right? It's empty of being one thing or the other from its own side. Huge, vast, vast subject. What is it that forces me to see this as a pen and the dog to see it as a chew toy? are the karmic seeds that we planted. So emptiness and karma, the Buddha always taught them together. Karma and emptiness go together. There is nothing that is self-existent self from its own side, and it expresses itself and it perceives the world around it based on its karma. Okay. Yes.
So you're sort of saying there's no inherent essence in the object.
It's available. This is available to be penned to you and then Chitoy to someone else. And the same is true of ourselves. That's really the. And modern physics, you were talking about that. It blew everyone's mind when they realized light could be both a particle and a wave. Very similar. So we could say that light is empty of being either or exclusively a particle or a wave from its own side. So, just so that I've kind of given you a little tiny glimpse of it. And again, Venerable Tenzin Choki is coming, and she's going to be going more into, going back, yes. So, wisdom is always comes from the practice of meditation. And then Venerable Tenzin Choki is coming, and she's going to be going into this in the Buddhism in a nutshell. And then again, these are the other things she's doing this Sunday, sharing the Dharma, Monday night meditation, and a day long on death and dying in the Buddhist tradition on March 31st, I think.
24th.
Oh, 24th. Whoops, 24th. Sorry about that. So, yes.
Will those things be posted on your website?
Yes. Which is currently down for maintenance.
Sorry
about that.
Future.
Yeah,
really bad. Okay, so you're going to put it. Okay, good.
And it should be up. It was supposed to be up already, so hopefully it'll be up soon. Another path, and I wanted to just point this out because it's something that we hear about a lot, is the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And this is actually one of the first Tibetan religious books published in the West. It describes our death process and what to do in order to use it as a method, as a pathway to enlightenment. So it actually is descriptive of the pathway to enlightenment through meditation. But you have to, here's a caveat, you have to have good enough meditation that you can continue to meditate from the moment you start to die, through your death, to after your death, right? I don't know about you, but I've got a ways to go on that. And then it's one of the various methods of liberation. Okay? And that's really what it's about. I was trying to think of some other things I didn't want to have you leave without. One is, you'll see these in all schools of Buddhism, but these are stupas, and I just wanted to mention that these are religious, symbolic constructs. And so here's a picture of an early stupa in India, because again, Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. And then here's a pagoda when it came to China. There's something similar in Japan. And it actually, all stupas have these symbols of the different elements, which some of you may find very interesting. And the elements have resonance with certain states of mind and meditation as well. So when you see a stupa like this, and you'll see people, here's a very famous one down here called Bodhma, and it's in Nepal. Some of you may have been there. And you'll see people circumambulating, because it's considered to be auspicious, circumambulating these stupas. And so this is one up in Tibet. This is in Tibet. This is actually Samye Monastery, where the great debates were held that we talked about between the Chinese and Master Kamala Shila that turned Tibet into a Tibetan nation, a Buddhist nation. This is that monastery, a glimpse of it from the outside. And then the last thing I wanted to just mention briefly, because you've probably heard about it, the idea of chakras came into our world two ways, one through the yoga and the other was through Tibetan Buddhism. So Tibetan Buddhists practice with chakras, which are these, if you've ever done any kind of Eastern medicine or Eastern practice, the idea of prana or chi, the energy in our body, and it has different focal or gathering points. And there, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's often four main chakras, and the other three are just mentioned and not practiced with as much, whereas in yoga, there's always usually the seven, as far as I know. And they're related to those five elements that we saw in the stupas, okay? So, again, this is like a very brief overview, introduction to things that if you start to go into a Tibetan center and Tibetan practice, these are things that eventually you would be really encountering and working with. Okay, is there someplace you want to jump in here? Okay. All right, so that was kind of really finishing up from last week. Okay, questions? This point, or all? Yeah.
When you do your, like that, mm-hmm. is that the four chakras?
It's representative body, speech, and mind. And so you're, because the mind is here, not here.
Right.
So it's so confusing to us because we think mind, speech, and body, right? But it's the opposite way. It's body because this is representative of our whole, crown chakra actually represents our whole physical, you know, like that this is our body. Speech is our throat. And mind. And so it's this blessing that our body, speech, and mind become the body, speech, and mind of an awakened being. And yes, they do correlate with three of the four main chakras.
And what is the fourth chakra?
This chakra right here, when you meditate, if you put your hands here, it's the navel chakra.
Okay.
Which is a chakra of where your kind of personal power actually gathers. It's like very interesting because it's also where dancers really develop. If any of you have ever done dance, or if you're doing martial arts, you always gather your energy right here. It's considered that. So I promise we talk about tonkas today, right? And the images. So tonkas actually are paintings. This is a photo of a place in India outside of Dharamsala that my husband and I actually got to visit. It's called Nargalinga. You could go there and do a tonka painting course. They take Westerners. It's one of the very few places it does. And to do it properly, I asked them. They said, if you did something very rudimentary, 3 months. If you wanted to really do something rudimentary and do it well, 6 months. And anything other than that, it would be 6 months to a year to really begin to even learn the specifics of the steadiness of tonka painting. And often what you'll see, tonkas are, they have different functions. So you can see some of them here. This is a mandala, right? Which we'll talk about in a minute. Or maybe I'll just say now. Mandala means an inner and an outer surround. Also just talk about a sacred circle. And sometimes they're considered to be kind of creating sacred worlds, right? And so each of these Buddhas has their own mandala, their own sacred world. And that's what these represent. Tonkas also are historical depictions. So sometimes you'll see the life of the Buddha. This one's one of the Dalai Lamas, if I remember correctly. I did see it when I put it up there. And so it's a historical depiction of this particular Dalai Lama's life. And it would be in a full tonka like this. And so it would be hung maybe in a temple or someone's room or a small center like this. And you could come in and learn about that particular figure's life through looking at the sacred painting. It's also a teaching tool. So this is a tonka of the nine stages of meditation up to the entry-level vajanas. And then there's also the tonkas like we see surrounding us with those of the deities, right? Which we'll talk about. So mandalas, here are a couple of examples, and they're used in rituals, in practices to enter particular states of mind. Mandalas are most frequently, you'll see them as paintings, you also, how many of you have heard of the sand mandalas? Yeah. Have you, any of you seen them when the monks are here? Yeah. So they do them with colored sand, and it takes days and days and days to create them. And then they'll float away, right? That idea of impermanence.
I want to mention that Trinity Episcopal Cathedral downtown, Dean, Brian Baker.
We love him.
I think every year invites some Tibetan Buddhist monks to do a mandala, and they build it in a side chapel of the cathedral, and they have a, what do you call that, a live cam or something?
Yeah.
I don't know. They've got a camera that's got a constant feed to the internet, so you can watch the monks building the mandala.
They do that every year.
I think it's...
Wow.
Well, I'm a little away from that life right now, but it used to be every year, and Brian's still there.
Oh, I'll have to ask him.
Yeah.
And so each one of this, each layer and each symbol also has a very complex symbol in there. One of the things, the tapas you'll see in every center, the Buddha actually, there's a long story about this wheel of life, but he said it should be in every monastery and every center. Ours is on the door and it's hanging crooked right now. And the wheel of life, this is Yama, this is the Lord of Death, and this represents the six realms and reincarnation. And then it shows two different ways we can, and here's the core, greed, hate, and delusion. And then it shows on the outer ring how we can either get out of samsara, which means the circle of our suffering life into enlightenment, or we continue to go from rebirth to rebirth to rebirth. So this is one of those mandalas that someone would meditate on and really meditate on each realm, on the 12 links of causation, which is embodied in it symbolically, and get teachings on it, and then go and come to the point where you would actually begin to enter that world of death and the end of death, as we know. So, who's who, right? Buddhas and bodhisattvas. And as we're going to start, I was thinking about, why do they exist? I was kind of anticipating someone saying, do they really exist? And it made me think about, have you all heard of Joseph Campbell?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Joseph Campbell did this amazing show called The Power of Myth. And if you haven't seen it, I highly, highly recommend it. And it's this idea of mythos versus logos, right? So mythos, logos is knowing the world through fact and experiment and observation. And mythos is knowing the world really through meaning and symbol and intuition, non-linearly. And Joseph Campbell had one of his favorite stories was that he was in Japan for a conference with a friend, with various people, and there was he overheard someone say to a Shinto priest there, we've been now to a good many ceremonies and seen a great deal of your shrines, but I still don't get your ideology. I don't get your theology. And this Japanese Shinto priest paused for a moment and then slowly shook his head and he said, I don't think we have an ideology. He said, we don't have a theology. We dance. Which is kind of pointing to that sense of myth, of creativity, of that part of life that is where our hearts, our minds, our beings are really impacted by what has heart, what imbues this life with aliveness. And so it's symbols, it's instinct, it's feeling, it's creativity, it's that intrinsic knowing, right? And so when we're working with these deities, with these figures, we're really trying to activate and connect with something that lives inside of us that might not really be linear, but might be incredibly powerful in our inner stories. Now, another reason they exist with such complexity, like I mentioned, when we saw those photos of Tibet and how barren and devoid of color it is, think of that being in that and how much time you would have, how much longing you would have for color and complexity. Right? Maybe not as great for our life now. So that's one component. Buddhas are the enlightened beings. Bodhisattvas are those who have taken the Bodhisattva's vow, which means to reach enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So they're kind of partway between being a human being and a Buddha. They're not fully enlightened yet. So in that way, they're really a metaphor, an embodiment of the qualities that we ourselves are cultivating. They're a little bit closer to us than a Buddha, so often we can think, hey, I can make it to being a Bodhisattva. I might not make it to being a Buddha in this lifetime, but that I can do. And There was a person whose name I meant to, who did a slideshow and he put it out there for public use. I was like, great, just what I need. So they're classified according to kind of what family they're in, not just gradation. It is gradation of enlightenment, but also to how it is that they express themselves in the world. And then one of the things when we look at tankas and deities, and you try to figure out who's who, you look at their hand gestures, their mudras. Are you all familiar with that idea of mudra? So there's a symbolic way, a hand position that's depicted in Buddhist art, and it's used in practice to evoke another quality of our being. Now, you may think this is weird, but if you've ever studied someone like Tony Robbins, and he has his power pose, so before you go in for an interview, you get into a pose, and you hold your pose for a certain amount of time, and that evokes confidence, right? And then you go in, and you just, what's it called? Burn through that interview. You ace it, right? Because you've done the power pose. And so mudras are considered to be similar, and they're working with the energy system and so on. And so they're practiced with visualizations and mantra recitations at the same time. And they help us determine who's who in this art piece. So I thought I would just go through them extremely quickly. So this is Anjali. You see this all the time, right? And it basically means a gesture of welcome or reverence. And you see this all through Asia, too. Just a, you know, namaste, instead of waving hello. You know, little kids are like, namaste, namaste. Meditation mudra, right? Where you rest, you're depending on your tradition, your right hand on your left, or your left on your right, and in your lap here, like this beautiful Kuan Yin she's doing. And this is the idea here of resting the mind, but also of tranquility, of ease and movement. And it's the union of masculine and feminine, the union and transcendence of motion and stillness has a lot of different meanings. Right? Balance. Then this is called the Dharma Chakra Mudra. And this means... Dharma, the wheel, chakra is wheel, so it's the wheel of Dharma mudra. And this is one of the teaching mudras, and apparently it is the mudra that the Buddha did when he first began to teach after his enlightenment. And so it means, I am about to turn the wheel of Dharma. I'm about to give you a teaching. Again, each of these mudras we could talk about. This has a symbolism of the three, of the eight Eightfold Paths and the three types of practitioners and so on and so on. So each one of these has an incredible complexity. Then Vidarka? Did I leave an A out of there? I feel like I did. Is another teaching mudra. And in this one, that same at the heart. And it's always at the heart because this means that the teachings are coming from the heart, right? They're the heart of the Buddha. They're the heart of the teachings, right to your heart. And then this is an offering gesture, so it can also be a generosity, so teaching and the generosity of giving, or then this is the same one, only it's point it down and put it up. So this is Amitabha Buddha. And then Bhumisparsha is the earth-touching mudra. And this always indicates a Buddha, because what happened was in the Buddha's enlightenment, he called the earth to witness. And so the right hand is down, and notice palm is towards him. It's resting on his knee or her knee, depending on what the Buddha is. And that's saying the Mara, the opposing forces, came to the Buddha just before he's about to be enlightened and said, "Who do you think you are that you have any right to be enlightened? You're just a normal human being." And the Buddha reached down and touched called the earth to witness. And the earth goddess rose up and claimed the Buddha as her divine son and said, "This is the one, this is the Buddha." And that's referencing this story. Then Abhaya is one, a mudra of peace or dispelling fear. I think if I'm going to look to Jay, my Sanskrit person, Bhai would be fear, right? And so ah would be negative. So
like anatta, abhaya means fear.
So no fear, dispel. So it's the mudra of dispelling fear. It also means pacifying, reassurance, protection. And
it is also like accepting the refuge.
And accepting refuge?
Giving refuge.
Oh, giving refuge. And they say also blessing, right? Like.
Yeah.
So this idea of blessing. And the idea is that after, quick story, that after the Buddha was enlightened, he had a cousin who was really jealous. And so he wanted to kill the Buddha. So evidently, even if you become enlightened, it doesn't get rid of all your enemies. It doesn't mean suddenly you're beloved by everyone. And so the Buddha was going down this path and the road into a village, and his cousin sent this rampaging elephant right towards him, and the Buddha just stood there totally free of fear and held up his hand like that, and the elephant stopped. Just kind of, I imagine him putting out his trunk and kind of giving you little elephant kisses. And then Varada?
Varada.
Varada. The mudra is the mudra of giving or generosity. So see, this is like the same mudra of the touching the earth, only the palm is out. So whenever you see the palm out like this, it's generosity, giving. So when you're looking at different Buddhas and these different images now, this doesn't cover all of them, but you can begin to see that this is one of the differences. So we're Shakyamuni Buddha, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you look at Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha, right? The guy, the dude, and who now used to say lived in 400 BC or BCE, and now we're saying 600, so 200 years earlier. Lots of new changes, different in Buddhist scholarship, which is exciting to us Buddhist geeks. Sakya was his clan name. Muni meant like sage, so it's Muni of the Sakyas. And you can see the mudra here is touching the earth. Right. And that's medicine. He's holding a medicine bowl because he's not a medicine Buddha, but it's actually nectar, and it, because his teachings are what dispels all our sufferings. It's the medicine that cures all ills. And then the next one is Maitreya Buddha, who is the future Buddha who's going to come in this era, hopefully, to basically, I think if you talk to a Buddhist who's like his the Dalai Lama, the Dalai Lama really, I understand, not that I'm in his mind by any means, but from what I've heard, believes that Jesus and Muhammad and these other great figures were enlightened beings, you could call them Buddhas, who came to really dispel the pain of the world through their spiritual teachings. And so that there will be one after this Buddha, this present cycle completes itself. And Meanwhile, this Buddha hangs out in a place called Tushita Heaven and is usually drawn sitting down, and look at the hands there are in the teaching mudra, the Dharma Chakra mudra. So that's how you know. And then ignore the five Buddhists. I decided to do them later, and we're just going to do Amitabha. Amitabha. Can't aspirate. There's Amitabha right there, another version of Amitabha. Yeah. I mean, Artanka of Amitabha. And interesting, this is part of the lotus family and transforms the idea of this Buddha. What is so powerful is that he transforms our desires into wisdom. Right? And what that means is really, it's mythic, it's a story, it's that power pointing out that we ourselves have the capacity to transform this intense energy of desire into a spiritual wisdom. It's always read. His direction is west. And what's interesting about Amitabha is that he dwells and hangs out in a paradise called Sukhavati. And he made this promise that whenever someone called his name, he would appear. So he's a Buddha of wisdom, but also great compassion. And so then he would take all of those who really called out to him with their whole heart sincerely and with great devotion, he would take them to Sukhavati. And because of that, he's very popular in Tibetan Buddhism, but in China and Japan, he's known as Amida Buddha, and that's the pure land sect. And so sometimes you'll come across someone who says, I chant Namikyo Rinikyo, or I'm a Pure Land Buddhist. It's this, they're praying to the Amida Buddha, Amitabha, right? So it's this Buddha here from Sukhavati. And Sukhavati means the Pure Land or the Sweet Land.
Where is the Pure Land prevalent? Which part of the world is that?
It's prevalent really in Japan and China. Or was in China, and it's not unpopular in the rest of the world, but it really is dominant, especially now in Japan. Namikyo Rinikyo comes from Japan.
Korea,
thank you. I knew I was missing one. Thanks. Yeah, Korea, Vietnam, that part of Asia. Yeah.
I'm just realizing, I always pictured a good number of the five Buddha families as female. And I always thought that Amitabha was as well. That's like always how I see the picture. I don't know why. But the five Buddha families are all male?
Well, you can't say that they're male, and you can't say that they're female. So technically what happens is it says here that they're always depicted with the male and female aspect, the masculine and feminine aspect. So they're really never supposed to be presented just as masculine. And so they always have the feminine aspect as well. So you'll see them in the feminine form and in the masculine form. And I literally just ran out of time. I was going to go through and put all the female forms in there too. Mm-hmm. And so I apologize to all the females and all of us, because the feminine in all of us, because I didn't mean to do that, just ran out of time today. Good question. So let's take a 5-minute break and come back and
So I'll send that out, and I apologize. I did send it out, and then I walked out with it still in the printer.
And also, we do have books over here on this bookshelf. And so feel free to look through them. And if you see any that are in interest of you, feel free to take them. And if they make it back here, awesome. If They don't.
And we have a little donation box there if you want to think of yourself as buying it. Which is what I do way too frequently when I look at that shelf.
Yeah, and if you have Dharma books that you are no longer using, you can bring them here, but we just ask that they're Dharma books and they're not.
And then, just again, I think you've all heard the announcements. Just a reminder, next week, Sunil and I will start on the Tonglin practice, the practice of compassion, and giving and taking, and it will be fun.
Alright, so I wanted to switch gears, sort of, not really, to talk about a bodhisattva. So we've been talking about the different Buddhas, and I want to talk about a bodhisattva. So bodhisattvas, I like them, one of the slides that Ami had, it said they're like the embodiments of the qualities of a Buddha. They really like walk the talk. So one of the bodhisattva, well, I consider him a bodhisattva in Amitabha's Master Sangha. And there's a story from his life that starts out with him meditating in a cave. So a picture here. I'm sorry to see this slide. But Master Sangha went to a cave and meditated for 12 years in the cave, doing a practice where he was meditating to Maitreya, the future Buddha that I was talking about. So he was trying to get a contact. And after 12 years of not being able to contact Maitreya, he got frustrated and he left the retreat, he left the cave, quit. And so he's walking back into town and he finds his dog. And so he's walking back into town and he is on this road and he comes across a dog that's dying on the road. And the dog has like a big open wound. And so and there's worms in the wound. And so out of compassion, it just like really wrenched his heart. And he wanted to help the dog. And so he wanted to get the worms out of the wound, but he didn't want to kill the worms either or harm the worms. So he thought, what could I use to get the worms out without harming them? So he thought, oh, my tongue is soft and warm, so I could use my tongue to not harm the worms. And I just out of this like deep overwhelming concern for the dog and the worms, his heart went out to them. And that's when all of a sudden the dog transformed into Maitreya in front of his eyes. So it was no longer a chew toy, it became a pen, right? So it was no longer a dog, it became Maitreya, the Buddha. And the Maitreya said, now you have compassion, now I can teach you. Mm. And story goes that Maitreya takes the Sangha to heaven and he teaches him the Abhisamaya Alamkara, ornament of realizations. So while Maitreya is teaching the Sangha, Sangha writes it all down like dictation. So Maitreya is kind of giving him this teaching and he writes it down. And this text, The Ornament of Realizations, is a text that kids in the younger monks in the monastery memorize. 75 pages they memorize as a child. So the Abhisamaya Alamkara,
the beautiful water.
So it's main subject is what is refuge? What does it mean to go for refuge? Who is the person that you go to refuge for? Or what are the three jewels? And what are the parts of the Buddha jewel and what are the parts of the Buddha. So that text covers these subjects. And they're studied and debated for 12 years. And that I like what Geshe Soltram mentioned, the Geshe that we have that comes here and teaches. He said it doesn't take 12 years to study and unpack that whole text, but they'll study it and review it once, and then they'll go back to the beginning and review it again, and they'll go back to the beginning and review it again, and just go deeper and deeper and deeper. And how you like read a book, and you get, you know, you have an experience with a book, and then you go back and read it again, maybe even the same page a different day, and it has like different meanings, and you kind of read the words a little differently. So it's kind of that thing where you go back to the subject, and for you, you uncover different meanings, and it touches you differently. So that. So they study it, and it comes came from a sangha dictated from Maitreya. Okay. Can you open up? Let's see. I guess Vajrasattva.
Mm-hmm.
48. So another Buddha is Vajrasattva, and the Tibetan for Vajrasattva is Dorje Senpe, and definitely a Buddha in the Mahayana, Vajrayana, Mahayana tradition. It's associated with the Sambhogakaya. Which body is the Buddha? That I think that's the Buddha, that's the bliss body. So it's like there's different bodies of a Buddha or parts of a Buddha, and one of the parts of a Buddha is the actual like enlightened body that they experience joy and bliss within. And so you Vajrasattva is a purification practice. So you would use it. I would use it, but this was kind of neat. If you know who Nagarjuna is, Nagarjuna was said to have met Vajrasattva in an iron tower in South India and was taught Tantra. Vajrasattva practices are common to all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. I found this picture online, it was pretty cool. It's His Holiness the Dalai Lama with the major figureheads of all the other schools. I recognize them, but I don't know their names.
See if I can tell, because this is, whoops. That's a Karmapa. That's the female lineage holder of the Sakyas. And I'm trying to figure out which one's her brother. I think that's the brother. So that's Sakya. Sakya school. Kagyu school. Galupa school. This would be Galupa in the background. What I'm not seeing is Enigma person that I recognize, but that's okay.
So Vajrasattva is a purification practice. You do it kind of to ready yourself for other practices in Vajrayana or Tantra. So the Vajrasattva practice done in an open way contains a lot of elements that are slightly tantric or are tantric, but they're very introductory and safe to practice with. Purify any broken vows. So this is why someone would do a Vajrasattva practice. Yeah. Good question.
I'm lost, but that's okay. I'll catch up. Because
okay.
I'm just wondering what that is, the practice, the, Nindro? N-G-O-N-D-R-O.
Nindro is a, is a word for like a preparatory practice, or there are like, five or 6 different nindras or preparatory practices that you could do. That would be, like, prostrations is one of them. So sometimes in Bodh Gaya, there, I've never been there, but there are monks that are doing a prostration practice or one of the nindra practices, doing like 100,000 prostrations in like 3 to 6 months, something like that.
Tibetan Buddhism is something we mentioned back way at the beginning, which I'm sure we all remember, is sometimes called Vajrayana.
Mm-hmm.
Vajrayana is the tantric path. And before we study tantra, when you transition from doing all these open classes and studies, and you're going to study tantra in order to accumulate, to purify anything that could be an obstacle, and in order to accumulate enough goodness in yourself, you would do these preparatory practices, and those are called preliminary practices, as Gunji said, nindra. And just as Ryan was saying, that can include offering practices, prostration and purification practices, like using prostrations. One of those is doing Vajrasattva recitations and visualizations. So there's quite a few that you would do, 110,000 of each one. And it would be dependent on which school you're doing it in and what your teacher asked you to do. And then they would feel that, okay, now you're ready to enter and successfully practice Vajrayana.
The meditation that we did in the beginning, there was a part in it where Ami said if anything's like weighing on your heart,
mm-hmm.
and you could offer it. So the Vajrasattva can have that flavor of working with something like that's weighing on your heart, or if you harm someone or did any kind of actions like that, you could use it, the Vajrasattva, as a practice for that. Yeah, we thought so. But I put a little picture of something like cleaning, purifying. And the mantra that you would do associated with the practice. 100 syllable mantra is a long one version, just a short version also. Okay, here we go. So we said that. Okay. And should I do another Buddha, the medicine Buddha?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
This medicine Buddha. Which one is the, we have medicine Buddha over there. I think that's the one medicine Buddha that we have. Vice. Yeah. Vice. Yeah, Guru. I think that's. What is Jaya? What is that? Can you?
Vaishajaya. Vaishajaya means master of medicine. Yeah, king of medicine. So, king of medicine master. And Guru is.
Thank you. It's a Buddha of healing and medicine, Mahayana Buddhism. He cures our suffering. Using the medicine of his teaching. He's typically depicted wearing the 3 robes of a monk. And those represent the 3 different kinds of vows that a monk could have. One of the sets would be the Bodhisattva vows that we talked about earlier. And there's the Vajrayana vows, and then there's another preparatory vow set called the Pratimoksha vows. That involve like non-killing, non-stealing, sexual purity, or like not committing adultery or something like that, and so on. Is usually holding a lapis colored jar of medicine nectar. Yep, got it.
So pretty. Yeah, the blue one.
The right hand is resting on the holding stem of the runa fruit. And I think a lot of the teachings on the Medicine Buddha, he studied it extensively. He learned about, how to work with plants, like the Tibetan medical system, and how to work with plants for healing, and how to work with the energy system of the body. He has an aura of lapis lazuli colored light. And it's a practice very powerful for healing and increasing healing powers both for oneself and others, but also for overcoming inner sickness of attachment, hatred, and things. So it can help physical and mental peace and suffering. And usually there's like 7 or 8 medicine Buddhas around, but when you do the practice, you pray to each one individually, and then they would, it's kind of cool there. I think they're all like in a vertical column, and they, right here, they're in a circle, but one of the practices, they each like melt into each other down the row, and then they would melt into the main figure, and then you would dissolve that into yourself, I believe. It's kind of, feels pretty good. And there's a mantra associated, different mantra associated with the Medicine Buddha. It's a Tayatam beckons and beckons in, Maha beckons in, Maha. Raja Samabhakti. Oh, Raja Samabhakti. Okay. Prostrate to Medicine Buddha, great physician, king of physicians, radiating lapis lazuli light. So you would like learn the word, you would learn the mantra, learn the words, and then let the words kind of affect you or touch you in some way. The meaning of the words would touch you. So then you would really use that emotion or the feeling that resonates with the words, and just repeat the words and try and really get in touch with that feeling and let it impact you. And do the mantra, kind of like the rosary. Okay, that's nice.
Okay, this will switch back.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Yes?
There's a place called the Land of the Medicine Buddha.
In Santa Cruz, yeah.
Santa Cruz?
Uh-huh.
Can you say a little bit about that place?
It's associated with FPMT. It's an FPMT center, so Lama Zopa Rinpoche. They do the Medicine Buddha practice there. They teach other like Tibetan Buddhist courses and topics there. And there's nuns and monks living there. And they have a big prayer wheel, like a really big prayer wheel,
yeah.
Maybe half the size of half this room or something like that. And you can camp there. And there's a big temple. I don't know if you call it temple at the top of the mountain. There's like you could go for a walk up the mountain, and there's like 100-foot tall Buddha statue inside this temple, and there's all kinds of glass stupas inside. It's just a very beautiful place.
Okay. So, Avalokiteshvara Chenrezig. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is considered to be a manifestation of this Buddha or Bodhisattva. Sometimes the line blurs, so Bodhisattva of compassion. And this Bodhisattva really is considered to embody the compassion of all the Buddhas. It's like a quintessential compassion. And this can be a two-armed, four-armed, or six-armed. I mean, thousand-armed. And the mantras of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and of Avalokiteshvara, or Chenrezig, is Om Mani Padme Hum, which you've probably heard, right? If anyone's heard a mantra, often it's this one, Om Mani Padme Hum, which can be pronounced different ways, but there's a lot of, if you get online and you put right in Om Mani Padme Hum, a lot of kirtan musicians have turned those into different chants and so on.
What kind of musicians?
Pardon?
You said a certain type of musician?
Kirtan, K-I-R-T-A-N, and that's devotional music that actually comes out of the classical Indian tradition. Mm-hmm. And we actually just had a Kirtan band here on last Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And Jay's part of it. So if you're interested, you can talk to Jay, who's sitting behind you.
Okay.
And he's also depicted sometimes, it's actually often considered as very androgynous, so it's hard to tell if Avalokiteshvara is a he or she sometimes. And it's sometimes depicted with 11 heads, 1,000 arms, and then you have the 5 heads here on this one. And the story is that before Avalokiteshvara became a bodhisattva and was a human being who was meditating and really doing a compassion meditation and was meditating on all the suffering of the world, and it was just, I don't know, maybe you've had this experience, but it touches your heart, and then it starts to almost get overwhelming when you think of what's happening in Africa and what's happening in, you just name it, all the parts of the world, all the suffering. And so it touched his heart so much that they said it just started to build up with this pressure to the point where his head exploded, because he just felt like he couldn't stand it anymore and he needed to be able to respond. And so suddenly his head exploded and out came 5 heads and out came 1,000 arms, because of the compassion became so great. And, you know, sometimes they talk about we either break down or we break open. And so it's this thing that Avalokiteshvara showed us, that instead of breaking down in the face of the overwhelming suffering of the world, we can break open and then respond in with this loving compassion and wisdom and have a huge impact on the world. Manjushri, so the two wings of enlightenment, compassion. One is represented by Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig family, and the other is by Manjushri. And Manjushri is considered to be the bodhisattva of wisdom. And he always has a sword. So the sword that cuts through all ignorance and all self-clinging. Right? And so it can be considered very fierce. And if you look closely, do we have a Manjushri here? I don't think we really should have. We don't have enough tankas. If you look closely, he always has a little bit of fur of brow. What's that?
That one up there is white Tara.
This is white Tara, yeah.
Yeah.
This is white Tara. This is Buddha.
And Buddha in the center.
And this is Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. This is Jetsongkhapa, the head of our lineage. Amitabha, Medicine Buddha, Green Tara, and White Tara. And then he is holding a flower that has a lotus flower, and resting in the lotus flower is a book, and the book is Prajnaparamita Sutra. And Prajnaparamita is the wisdom sutras, the wisdom part of the tradition, which talks all about emptiness and dependent origination, the idea that nothing arises by itself. We don't rise by ourselves. We're not self-arisen, right? We didn't suddenly magically come here. We came here dependent on our mother and our father and them taking care of us, or someone taking care of us and feeding us before we could feed ourselves. And when you start to think of all the causes and conditions that came together for us to be alive even to this moment and sitting in this room, again, it's mind-blowing. And so that's another aspect of emptiness, that there's nothing that exists without all these infinite interplay of causes and conditions and connections. And so he's holding that, and Prajnaparamita is considered the mother of all Buddhas. So he's always youthful, and he always has a furrowed brow because he's a little bit on the fierce side, right? If you met him in a dark alley, he'd be holding a book and swinging a sword. So there's a lot of power there. Then we get to the Taras, and we are most familiar, most of us, with white Tara, and this is what you'll see in most centers, is either or both white Tara and the green Tara, which we'll have up here. But there are actually 20, Tara comes in 21 flavors. and 21 flavors, actually there's 21 verses, and the 21 verses are chanted in most monasteries every morning. And there's one place in Saranath, which is right where the Buddha preached when he taught the first time that he taught, and I think some of you have been there. And there's a Tibetan Buddhist nunnery, and they are dedicated to 24/7 for the benefit of the world, for out of their gesture of compassion and their offering to the world, is to have someone chanting these 21 Taras at all time in their meditation hall. And we stayed there a couple years ago and offered to give the nuns a break. And it was really fun because it turned out they have it in English as well as Tibetan, thank God. Because I don't know how to chant Tibetan or read Tibetan. So all of a sudden I was like, wow, I'm sitting alone in this Tibetan meditation hall, just really gorgeous with all the Tibetan tankas and statues and colors. And for 2 hours, I was just chanting the 21 praises to the 21 Taras in English until the nun came in and took over. And so they do these 2 hours, 24/7 through the night. White Tara, the white color, will always is a color of gentleness, of healing, of longevity, of a certain type of longevity. And so she is known as the long of long life, Tara, has a sense of very, that maternal compassion, the mothering energy, and very much healing. And so she's really also could give very highly revered by new mothers, for instance. Green Taras are considered the mother of liberation, as well. I mean, they're both the mother of liberation. But she's a Buddha or Bodhisattva of enlightened activity, which is the energy of compassion that gets translated into action in the world. And so you see here, if you look close, and you look closely at this one, and there's one on the back wall, is she's stepping into the world with the right foot, because she's totally balanced compassion and wisdom, radiating compassion, and then ready, as soon as she sees something that needs to be done, she's stepping into the world. And then red Tara, now red is always that energy of fierceness, of fire, of passion. And she is the feminine aspect of Amitabha, where she turns desire into that loving compassion. Right? So when I said you can transform desire, it's just a raw energy, turn it into something. And red Tara symbolizes really turning that into a compassionate energy. Vajrapani, because often you'll hear of Vajrapani Institute. So Vajrapani was one of the first bodhisattvas and is very fierce, another fierce bodhisattva, and is considered to be one of the three main representations of a quality of a Buddha. So Manjushri represents the wisdom of a Buddha, Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig represents the love of a Buddha or the compassion of a Buddha, and Vajrapani is the power of a Buddha. So a Buddha has all these things, love, compassion, and power. And let's see. There is another FPMT institute called a center called the Vajrapani Institute, and it is in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and so there are a lot of Tibetan Buddhist programs that go on there, so you may hear that. And here are the five Buddha families. Amitabha is one of them. Ratnasambhava is yellow, and here you see them with their female and male aspects. Vairochana, Amoghasiddhi, and Akshobhya. And I mention them because you'll often see and hear about them not only in Tibetan Buddhism, but also in other Buddhist traditions throughout Asia. And these are like Buddhist psychology. So each one of these has a quality or an aspect of emotional psychological makeup. And so if you hang around Buddhist centers long enough that study the five Buddha families, instead of hearing, what's your sign, you'll hear, hey, what's your family? Oh, you know, I'm the Akshobhya family. Oh, I'm the Vairochana family.
Each has a different gang sign.
What's that?
Each has a different gang sign.
Yeah. Yeah, and each one has a different sign, different mudra, a different color, a different mold, a different, just all the different elements. So it's kind of like, yeah, when you join a family, you get all those accoutrements. Okay, so you have Shanti Deva. So let me, all right. So, who's who in terms now of people and titles? You're going to hear this a lot. Lama, which means guru, which means really a spiritual teacher, right? And if you want to know, a 1L lama is a priest or a teacher, and a 2L lama is a beast. It could be the other way around sometimes. So some people call me Lama Ami because I'm their teacher. And so at home I have a 2L lama cup and socks and other cute things people have given me. Rinpoche, so there is one of the things that is very distinct about Tibetan Buddhism is that the lama, the spiritual teacher, is really revered as the root of the path. Not in terms of giving away your power, but in terms of, I wouldn't be on this path without a teacher, right? I wouldn't know what to do. It's like having your coach. You just have this intense gratitude and devotion to your teacher for actually bringing you and seeing you along the spiritual path. And like I said, it's all the way up to enlightenment. So when you make a commitment to a spiritual teacher, to a lama, the lama makes a commitment to you to never give up on you, to never stop helping you until you reach enlightenment. So it's definitely a two-way commitment. It's not a one-way devotion that I throw myself power into you who's all-powerful and all-knowing. And the idea is the lama actually holds the belief in you that you don't have yourself. You don't yet believe that you can be a Buddha. The lama totally believes you can be a Buddha, and they actually see the Buddha that you're going to be, right? And so it's like going back to that midwifery analogy. It's the mentor I had in midwifery school who totally always saw the midwife I was going to be, even when I gave up on myself. Rinpoche, you'll hear that, means precious one. It literally means precious jewel or dear one. And it's similar to Mr. in terms of, it's like, what is that called when you say, what's your title? So it would be like Rinpoche, it would be precious jewel, meaning someone who is usually it's a reincarnated or bestowed title on a very high teacher. Geshe, like we mentioned, is the Lupa Tibetan Buddhist advanced degree, really means like professor or, you know, doctor. So Geshe Tsultrum's coming, it means he did his whole Geshe degree. A Siddha is a perfected yoga master. It's someone who's perfected a certain practice to the point where they're showing all the aspects of it. So again, in martial arts or in Reiki or something like that, you know, someone who's a master who totally has all these different aspects that someone who hasn't mastered it. And then a Tulku means someone who's reincarnated. So you'll hear like Tara Tulku or they're a Tulku, meaning they are a reincarnation of another master, or actually a reincarnated, in this sense, Rinpoche is usually reincarnated from one lifetime to another lifetime. They say Tulku can even be just an emanation of someone. So people that you'll hear a lot about around Tibetan Buddhism, of course the Dalai Lama, who is considered the spiritual head. The Panchen Lama is, I just spoke, I said the Karmapa and His Holiness Stager, they're taught last time, this is a new thing. The Karmapa is being groomed as the spiritual head of Tibetan people now, because the Panchen Lama was traditionally the one who did that, who chose the next Dalai Lama. And what happened was the 11th Panchen Lama was taken at this age by the Chinese into quote-unquote protective custody and has not been seen or heard from in many years now. So no one knows. Every once in a while, like a few, 6, 7, 8 years ago, there was some indication he was still alive, but we don't even know that. And then the Chinese appointed another Panchen Lama because they want to say to the Tibetan people, this Panchen Lama can choose the next Dalai Lama, which means that the Chinese will then control the Tibetan people through controlling the Dalai Lama. So it's very sad because by doing this, they broke a hundreds of years old tradition, and this young boy never got the education to really become the Panchen Lama. So the Karmapa, whom I talked about, we talked about last time, the head of the Karma Kagyu is being groomed to take over that role when His Holiness passes away, the Dalai Lama. Okay, so those are kind of living people, and then historical people, the Shantideva. And we'll go back to more living people if we have time.
There's a story about someone's master, Shantideva. Shanti means peace. You might hear in yoga, Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace. And Deva is like a deity or an angel. So, angel of peace. I put a picture of like a lazy looking cat. Kind of representing, and you'll figure out why soon. There you go. So really soon. So Master Shantideva, fast forward in his life, he is a monk at the Nalanda University, one of the really early major institutions where they're studying Buddhism in India. India, right? Yeah. And he was really not looked upon well in the monastery as a monk. He was given a name of someone that thinks really basically, like just has really small thoughts. He was seen as very lazy, so they called him Mr. Three Thoughts. So all he thinks about is eating, sleeping, and defecating. Because that's basically that's all they saw him doing. So, little did they. So, yeah, they talked about him. Alright, but they didn't know that he was a very special child. He was a prince, and he had an affinity for spiritual life, or studying the Dharma. And very early on, he's. Had really high qualities. And he was able to reach Manjushri at a very early age and get teachings from Manjushri at a very early age before he went to Nalanda and was a monk that everyone thought was crazy. He had already gained realizations and had been practicing, been meditating for a long time. So, at Nalanda, every once in a while, they would give hold a big ceremony and give teachings. And so who would give the teachings would rotate. The person that would give the teachings would rotate. And they kind of wanted to get him kicked out. So they were like, oh, okay, let's ask Shantideva, let's ask Mr. Three Thoughts to give the teaching. So we can really see who he is. You know, they asked him, and he said, how could someone like me ever be able to recite scripture? So he was like, no, I can't do that. And they kept asking him. So eventually he agreed. And so there was a big gathering, and they to make him look bad, they set up a throne. So usually the teachers, people that are teaching, there's like a throne that they sit on, and the Buddha image, the tonka behind, and they made a throne that was so big that no one could ever, like, it would be impossible to reach the top by yourself without a ladder, or something like that. So he walks up to the stage and goes to the throne, and then just puts his hand on it, and then immediately he appears at the top of the throne without any help. And they're like, what? Okay, what? Right, but remember, he's special, so he just appears at the top of the throne, and he asks them, "Do you want me to teach you something that we already know, or do you want me to teach you something that I made up, that I wrote?" And they're like, "Yeah, teach us something that you wrote, Mr. Three Thoughts." Right? And so then he proceeds to teach the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So he wrote that text. It's one of the major texts that is studied in the Kalupa tradition, and he narrates it by heart to them, and they very quickly are impressed. And there's some dispute over how many chapters there are in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Once he got to the chapter on wisdom, he started to levitate off of the teaching throne and go up into the air. And then supposedly some monks had clairvoyance, some advanced meditators, and they could still hear him talking, or they could still, he was like 30, 40, 50 feet up in the air and kind of flying away. And so some people said, he started flying away and that was when he finished the eighth chapter. So there's only eight chapters in the Bodhisattva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And then other monks were like, no, he was still talking, I could hear him, there's a ninth chapter, right? And then some other monks were like, no, he was actually kept teaching, there's a tenth chapter. And he flew to Burma, I think, or Sri Lanka. So he floated away to Sri Lanka. That's the myth. So yeah, so he wrote the way of the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. They went and found him. They were like, oh, can you come back? They're like, oh my gosh.
Didn't
know what we had, yeah. So can you come back? And he was like, he saw that it would be more beneficial if he didn't go back. So he said no. But he said, I wrote that text down and I left a copy in the rafters of my room so you can get the text up there. And inside the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, there's teachings on the six perfections. It's affiliated with the Bodhisattva vows that Heather's teaching right now on Wednesdays.
Okay, so you have a short time left. But I wanted to talk a little bit about Lama Yeshe and Lama Soka Rinpoche because they're affiliated with our center. We have a lot of teachers come through. And so in Lama Zopa is here, and Lama Yeshe is here. And Lama Yeshe was born in 1935, and Lama Zopo in 1946. And they didn't know each other, but one of the things that happened in the 1959 dysphoria was that there were two camps. India took in the Tibetan refugees and basically put them into two camps. And one big camp was in Buxa, which is in West Bengal area. And it's really interesting history because what happened was all these incredibly great monks and lamas and teachers and rinpoches and tulkus who never would have met each other otherwise met here, and it was an old British prisoner of war camp, actually. And so this is what the fort entrance looks like today. This is what it looked like when the Tibetans were there. And this is literally a picture of them when they were there in the early 60s. And so what happened was the Dalai Lama went between there and the other camp, and he asked them to start teaching and the little kids and making schools for kids and so on, and making sure that their culture continued and wasn't destroyed. And immediately, like, the monks were just, okay, you got to keep debating, you got to keep studying, and so on. So Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa met each other, and they became incredible heart-connected Dharma brothers, spiritual brothers. Now, I've heard that Lama Zopa would start bowing very low to Lama Yeshe, and he just revered him. And then Lama Yeshe, because Lama Zopa was a Rinpoche, in other words, a reincarnation, and had more spiritual status in the community, would bow low. And then they would get into this kind of hilarious, humorous bout of who can bow lowest, you know, to each other. And then meanwhile, they'd be cracking up and laughing and thinking it was great fun. So eventually, Lama Yeshe was asked to come and start teaching Westerners. He was invited to the West in 1974, and he fell in love with what he called those Western bushy people. You know why he called us the bushy people? 1974, wow. I mean, the early 70s. Remember his hair and beards? You know, so he called them the bush people or the bushy people. And people started, it was actually late 60s, early 70s, I think he came 1974 first, maybe it might have been even a bit earlier, and started teaching, and a group gathered around him in California, and didn't put up a map, but eventually he died in 1984, but so he didn't live very long. He had a heart condition. He had an enlarged heart that just kept getting physically bigger and bigger and bigger. And his students all said that's exactly how he was. He was so big-hearted and so humorous and so fun. And he used to say things like, your problem is you don't know how to enjoy yourselves. A lot. And what was he saying? I can't remember. That sort of thing. And so he and Lama Zopa started a series of centers that is now the biggest, probably largest network of Tibetan Buddhist centers around the world, called FPMT, the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition. They have a master's program in Italy. They have a college, an accredited college in Portland, Oregon, and they have centers all over the world. So Land of Medicine Buddha, Vajrapani, Ocean of Compassion, they're all in the extended Bay Area. There's another one that's name I've forgotten. And their students include Venerable Tenzin Chukyi, who's coming, and Elaine Jackson, who's going to be coming probably in April, hopefully. And so there's a lot of kind of crossover with them. So you'll hear their names, and they're both on the altar up here. All of the names. Yeah.
How does it become Rinpoche?
A Rinpoche is that you are recognized usually as a child. But we didn't even talk about it. Like, how does the Dalai Lama get recognized as the Dalai Lama? It's really fascinating to see a small child, 2-year-old Rinpoche. They'll show extraordinary, they'll either start talking about memories, and someone will walk up and they'll say, oh, I remember you from the monastery in my last life, and then start talking about things that no one else could know. Or they'll recognize, they'll start showing extraordinary compassion, or start spontaneously giving teachings on emptiness. And so then, if the parents or the local Lama teacher notices this kind of behavior, they'll ask some of the higher Lamas to come check this kid out and say, hey, we got this kid here, come check him out.
So this is
like, you know, 1, 2, 3 years old, sometimes up to 6, but they're very young. and then they'll do some testing of them and so on, and they'll say, oh, you're the reincarnation of so-and-so from this monastery and so-and-so. So you become a Rinpoche by being recognized as a reincarnation by someone else.
There's a movie about it called The Unmistaken
That's
Child,
right. Yeah.
That is fascinating. They go looking for a specific reincarnation. In fact, it's his, like, what's the biggest name? This helper that actually ends up going looking for this dude. It's a fascinating movie, The Unmistaken
Child.
The
Unmistaken Child. We need to start our movie nights again.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so the cool thing is I've watched footage and of these little 2-year-old Rinpoches. I mean, think of a 2-year-old.
Their names are Mara
and Mara. They go over your head.
They're all dwarfs.
And they sit there during the ceremonies, and they'll be sitting on the throne. And imagine, I mean, I raised a 2-year-old and was around other 2-year-olds and was recently around one. They don't stop moving, right? They're running all over the place. I mean, it's a crazy time. They don't know the name. The meaning of the word no, and they got legs to run on. So but these two year old, they sit there totally balanced, calm, focused for hours during these teachings, and then people come up and give offerings, like their old students will come and make offerings, and they'll just make the offerings back, and you're sitting there going, this is weird. You know, it's almost a little scary. This is a 2-year-old acting like a very old soul that they are. All right. Turn for Rinpoche. Do we have time?
A quick.
What am I? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah. So one... a lineage that you might hear of or see around is the Shambhala centers, and they're started up by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And I like this picture because, I mean, he has some controversy around him, but his teachings, like, really, he did a lot of things to, like, wake you up or, like, to shock you out of your normal patterns. So I really like this picture. It's like, well, Buddhist teacher kind of giving the finger, like, you don't really see that, right? He was a meditation master and holder of both the Kagyu and Nyingma lineages. This is a picture of him at a lineage. And he was the abbot of the Surmain monasteries. And he was a scholar, teacher, poet, artist, originator of the Shambhala vision. There's a documentary of him on Netflix called Crazy Wisdom, and it really details his life. That's pretty interesting viewing. He was a major figure of Buddhism being spread to the West. He founded Naropa University. I think the first one was in Boulder, Colorado, and Shambhala training method. He translated various texts, and he introduced the Vajrayana teachings to the West. He was a major contributor of the tantric teachings that we talked about. Devoid of ethical trappings, so he tried to strip them of ethnic trappings.
Woohoo! Free problem.
Ethnic trappings. I think like trying to get the dogma out of them and just get really to the essence of the meaning of the teaching. He coined the term crazy wisdom because some of his teaching methods and actions were the topic of controversy during his lifetime. So his methods for teaching were very pretty controversial. Like, I think he dressed, I don't know, you gotta see the documentary, like he dressed up him and his students as like the military. Like military, and they would do rituals because he wanted some kind of culture that they were connected with that had emotional resonance for them, and working with that, it meant something more to his students. So he tried to really integrate, assimilate with our culture, and then use that to wake up. quadrion to the west. Is it some greeting? I don't know what that is. Another master.
Kensei.
What's that?
Kensei.
It's Kensei. So I found a couple quotes of other people talking about him. Gelug Rinpoche, who lived with Trungpa when they were young, said he was a great Tibetan yogi, a friend and a master. The more I deal with Western Dharma students, the more I appreciate how Trungpa presented the Dharma and the activities that he taught. Whenever I meet with difficulties, I begin to understand sometimes before solving the problem, sometimes afterwards, why Trungpa Rinpoche did some unconventional things. I do consider him to be the father of Tibetan Buddhism in the United States. I left early. And this was called Suzuki Roshi's. He was talking about Trungpa within the context of teaching on emptiness and how Trungpa supported his community and how you need support in nurturance when you're studying emptiness or the wisdom teachings. The way you can struggle with this is the way you can struggle with like learning about emptiness or the wisdom teachings is to be supported by something you don't know. As we are human beings, there must be that kind of feeling. You must feel it in the city you're building or community. So whatever community it may be, it's necessary for it to have this kind of spiritual support. That's why I respect Trungpa Rinpoche. He is supporting us. I may criticize him because he drinks alcohol like I drink water, but that is a minor problem. He trusts you completely. He knows that if he is always supporting you in a true sense, he will not criticize him. So he was just, it seems like he was just very supportive and there for students in his community in a genuine, sincere way. He just had really incredible pictures. I just see so much like expression and that love, I guess, and support through his mannerism. His name was Roland Das.
There's a video of that.
Yeah. Of him with Roland Das?
Yeah.
Yeah. And is it like on YouTube or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're running a little bit late, so I feel like we should close with our closing prayers. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming. It's been the first time I've done this, we've done this class. And people have, like I said, been asking about it for something like this for a long time. So we finally have to do it. And I hope you enjoyed it. And
And what are you doing next Tuesday?
Next Tuesday, it will be training in compassion, developing and cultivating compassion,
love.
Mm-hmm. And compassion and love, thank you. And I know what I'm teaching, I don't know what the title is. And what it's going to be is there's a practice called Tonglen, which is how we help take away people's suffering when we see it, and then including ourselves, and give them what they need, give them love. And so it's a very particular practice, and we're going to talk about how to develop compassion, how to soften and open our hearts using both this ancient Tibetan tradition and compassionate communication, which is really non-violent communication. So NVC methods to begin to see how do we begin to imagine what someone else is feeling and what their needs are and what their situation might be in a way that we can begin to become empathetic beings and react and then respond with compassion. And really for me, I wanted to teach this in part because I need that reminder. I need these teachings. I can teach what I need. Because I do find the world right now very challenging with all the suffering that's happening on so many levels. And so it's a good reminder of this practice is something we can do in our daily life, in the moment, on the ground, in a situation, and also as a meditation practice.
And will that be a series?
It'll be three classes again. It'll be three classes. Mm-hmm. And everyone's invited. You don't have to know about how to meditate or anything specific about it. It's very open practice.
Okay, cool.
And I'll be teaching at the studio. Okay.
Thank you.